Best Leaves Clues podcast with Robin Bailey and Al McDonald. Have you ever wondered what makes someone successful? What are they doing that's different? How do they achieve greatness? We believe that success leaves clues. In this series, we are interviewing very successful people from different walks of life to hear their stories. We'd like to remind our listeners that the views expressed in this podcast are those of our guests and not necessarily those shared by our hosts. Today's episode is sponsored by Life and Legacy Advisory Group. Discover our commitment to our clients. At Life and Legacy, building wealth, securing your family's future, giving back, and creating a lasting legacy are not just values, but a way of life. Let us guide you toward a future aligned with what matters most to you. We're also brought to you by Aria Benefits. If you're a business leader challenged with talent attraction, employee engagement, or supporting mental health, we can help. Use your benefits package as the key to unlock your workforce. Now here's your hosts, Robin Bailey and Al McDonald.
Welcome back to the Success Leaves Clues podcast. I'm your host, Robin Bailey, joined as always by my fantastic co-host, Al McDonald. Al, what are you saying these days? What's new and exciting in your world?
Well, always excited to be here on a Friday with Podcast Friday, and really looking forward to today's guest because we had a great conversation the first time around. And so I'm really looking forward to expanding on that and hearing a little bit more.
Yeah, absolutely, as am I. Well, we're thrilled to welcome Fahad Al-Hattab to the show. Fahad is a dynamic keynote speaker and the founder of Unicorn Labs. His work focuses on empowering startup founders through leadership coaching, facilitating transformative offsite team building retreats, and inspiring audiences to embrace their potential as unicorn leaders through impactful corporate keynotes. Fahad, it is such a pleasure to have you here. We met you at Tech Talent North. Watching you started out the day at that event and the energy you put into the room was amazing. And I just had to approach you and I'm just so happy you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. Yeah, it was definitely a fun event. And I'm glad you approached me. I'm glad we're here today having a deeper conversation about maybe some of the topics that we shared at Tech Talent North.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I've gotten to know you a little bit. And of course, I've been on your website and your LinkedIn. And of course, I see your posts and I see some of the videos of the speaking engagements you're doing, which is really exciting. But I want to talk about that unicorn leadership, because that's a really compelling concept. What inspired you to create the six levels that you talk about of unicorn leadership? And how can managers begin leveraging those principles to build these high-performing, unstoppable teams that we all want?
Yeah, good question, Robin. Actually, I was looking back the other day at just the amount of different projects as an entrepreneur that I've worked on, some successful, some miserably, you know, horribly bad, just didn't work out. And as I looked through kind of an old folder of them, you remember the different teams that you were on. And I think I got curious early on as to like, what made really good teams? What made really good leaders? Why is it that some teams were just far more enjoyable for me to work on? Some teams, despite the idea being mediocre, we still managed to like do really well with it. And what was the cause of that? And I think a lot of that curiosity was because I found myself naturally pulled into leadership positions. People would look to me and say, Vlad, can you lead this project? Or can you run us with this? And I sort of also reflect of like, how could I be a better leader? And that sort of my journey takes me through that. And we coined the term unicorn leader as we started to learn more about these leaders that really embodied the sort of power law impact, which is the idea that talent doesn't follow this general distribution where it's like, you know, half of us on the lower side, some of us on the better side, but leadership has this exponential impact. You're in a position of huge leverage, right? You're in charge of these people, or you have to get them on your side, and your direction and your vision is so influential. And when you start to look at it, we start to realize that leaders have this leverage point, but this leverage point is also a failure point. Right? You could be a phenomenal leader and use that potential impact, or you could be a horrible leader and it's still potential impact. It's just the other way. And I think that that's the key piece here, is that a leverage point doesn't necessarily mean a positive point. And I reflect back on my own leadership, like some of the projects that failed was because I was not in a good leadership place. I did not have the necessary skills. I was learning as I was going, you know, like, or we idolized the time, the Steve Jobs or the Elon Musk, like the sort of founder mentality of like, I'm going to will my vision into reality that doesn't really bring people along the way and actually build a team. And so what we found was these 10X leaders, these exponentially impactful leaders, they focused on one thing over the rest. The thing they focused on was building a team. It wasn't about just their idea. It wasn't about them getting the result. They actually focused on building a really high potential team with some phenomenal talent. I'll stop there for a moment, Robin, but I think that was the big insight for us was leaders with a high leverage point recognize their influence. And instead of just using their influence to get the result, they used it to actually build teams that could get the result.
So, Fahd, that's very interesting. And now I've met a lot of founders and entrepreneurs and business owners, obviously, over the last 29 years in this business. And this won't surprise you. And I would put myself in this category as well. Hey, surprise, surprise, we've got egos. And when you talk about building teams, early on, that was one of the big challenges I had for myself. Before you popped on today, I was talking with Al about a challenge I had that it's still hard for me to let go. So how do you work with those people who are those driven founders successfully build a team? How do you coach them through getting those teams and letting go? Because I found for me, that's been a challenge. And for people that I've talked to, that's been quite a challenge as well.
Yeah. And you know what, Robin, actually, that's an interesting one, because I think this one is the difficult piece that almost every founder faces. And I think we look at it a bit wrong. So most professional trainers go, you got to delegate everything. You got to let go. You got to give it all. I go, no, you don't got to delegate everything. You delegate everything. You're going to have a class of professional managers that are going to just be operating your existing system. So this is a key point that entrepreneurs are phenomenal at the explore side of a business, which is the exploration of a new idea, the creation of new systems, the innovation of technology. They're creative. They're usually very excitable. They can get excited over new things, but they usually kind of suck at the systems part, right? Which is the exploit part of the business. But guess what? The only part of the business that actually makes money is the exploit side. The exploit side is the efficient use of capital. It's when you take an idea and you make it efficient. Like your podcast, you go, I record on Fridays. You know, we do it this way. You've made it efficient so that it's a good use of time and has a good return. But when you were first doing it, it wasn't efficient. It was like, let's try do this and let's try doing that and that creative process. And so what I actually tell founders is what we want to do is we want to build a team that can help with the exploit side of the business, that can make your capital more efficient so that you can spend more time in the explore side, because I actually still need you in the innovative area because that is where your superstar skill set is. So this term has now been called founder mode. Paul Graham from Y Combinator and Brian, the founder of Airbnb, have talked about how founders at one point try to delegate so much that they let go so much of the business that the business stalls. Because what other leaders that you bring on are really good at doing, they're really good at taking existing systems and making them get better. They're really good at taking existing systems, making sure they follow the budget, making sure everyone's managed. They are managers. And the difference here with entrepreneurs who are fundamentally leaders at heart is that they're explorative and they're good at finding new ways of doing things. And they actually, they rattle things up. They actually frustrate the middle management class who go, oh my God, you keep changing things. But that's their goal. That's their point, is that they're supposed to drive change, and middle management should actually be a little bit of the filter to go, okay, that one can't work as efficiently just yet, Robin. So I need you to hold off until we can figure this out so that your new idea is actually profitable for the business. And so when we start to look at it this way, I go, hey, if there's parts that you want to control, let's identify that. Let's have you in your superpower. But then there are parts that you shouldn't be controlling, and let's give that away to give it to a good system. And I think that sits far better with some of our founders than what sometimes feels like, well, I need to delegate everything, then what do I do? And I had a CEO that we were coaching, and he said, Fahd, I don't feel useful in my own company. I sort of just get reports at this point. And I go, that's a mistake, because you're going to check out. Mm. You're a builder. Entrepreneurs, we're builders. We like to be like, you know, we buy Lego sets because we like to build. We tinker with 3D printers because you go, oh, what can I make? And we're no good at it. But like, that's the excitement of creation. And I think I never want to take that away from a founder. And when I do, I'm actually taking away part of the spirit of that startup.
Fahd, I'd love to dig a little bit deeper, because I want to hear about where you've emphasized and prioritized team performance over individual success, where you've gotten some real life examples of where that's worked. But I have a question even before that, because you said something in your very first comment about you kind of evolved towards leadership roles in a lot of the projects that you were working on. It almost sounded like it kind of just happened. So before we jump into some real world success, what do you think it is that made people just say, he's the guy that should be in charge?
Yeah. You know, I think some of that comes to the old age nature versus nurture question of leadership, right? Like it's sort of, are leaders born or are they made? And I think society has sort of swung between these ways. Like you look back 100 years ago when the science of genetics was really coming to be, most of us started to go, oh, okay, so things are genetic. So people are born. You're born the athlete, you're born the creative, you're born the leader. And then our society slowly swung the other way towards very much nurture. It was like, no, everyone's made. Everything is made. Everyone is created, can be trained into these roles. I think we're finding a space in between now as we're sort of understanding the science of epigenetics, saying, oh, there's some genetic disposition, and then you could train it. I like to think of leadership a little bit like if you put a five-year-old in hockey, and he's playing hockey since he's 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, he comes really good. He plays into triple A, this, that, he has fun. Hey, never makes it to the NHL, but like is phenomenal. And then you put me on skates for the first time when I'm 30. So is his hockey genetic or has he just been learning since he was 5? And I think that with leadership, when we feel like certain people have a genetic disposition, they've actually been exposed to informal leadership roles since they were really young age. And so I come from a family of 6. I have 2 brothers and 3 sisters. So we're a team. So we came to Canada in 1998. We landed on October 30th. I was young, all right? But we landed October 30th. All these memories are there for us, me and my siblings. Some of them are younger, some of them are older. I'm in the middle. And we land on October 30th. We like rest on the first day. My 2 parents there with us. Next day is October 31st. And the first time that we decide to go out and check out the neighborhood is obviously at 5 p.m. on October 30th. Right? And like all we see are little ghosts and goblins running around, knocking at people's doors. My mom was like, what devil worship is this? Like we have no idea. I'm like, is this what Canadians do every night? Like that was our only. And so we had this little team, 6 of us, that was like us 6, of course our parents, but because we were the translator generation, the generation in between our parents who were older immigrating to a new country and us being able to be nimble, we felt like a team. And I think that sort of taught me how to be part of a group. It's not about you. It's about what we all 6 need. It's how do I negotiate the needs of these people? And how do I still get my voice in? And I'm sort of in the middle. So I become the louder one, right? That needs to debate everything. And then I find myself out in like sports leadership roles a little bit. And then in grade 8, I'm my school president for grade 8 all the way to kindergarten because I do a really good speech and people like it. And then in high school, I'm representative of my grades. In high school, I was grade 12 student president. Then, of course, in university, I ran the student union. I was president of the student union for 2 years. So I sort of end up taking on different leadership roles. And I think to your question is, some of it I'm sort of pushed into through an inclination of, I have an idea of what we should do. So here's my idea. And I think leadership starts with having an opinion over what should be done, but actually being willing to do something about it. Mm-hmm. So I think we have a lot of opinions these days, but it's like, I have an opinion over how I think this group or this world or my community or my school could be better. And I'm going to try and do something about it. I'm not going to wait for permission. And I think that was the thing that you really learned. And I say I learned it being an immigrant to Canada, being a person of 2 worlds, you sort of sit at the edge of like, oh, I don't know what they're doing either. and so you gain a sense of agency as a young man and you go, oh, I get it. I can do something here. I can be something here. I can try this. And I think a lot of that led me to having an opinion, having experiences, trying to do things and being willing to try it. And so I think that's where the personal experiences of leadership and now having run several companies, you know, I have confidence in my own opinions and I'm well-read. I have research. I'm confident that I can figure something out. And I think that is what compels us to follow. But confidence without a certain level of humility is also a problem. And I think that's the other piece that the founders often have to develop to help ease the ego's need for that validation or for that, like, I need to lead everything, right? It's the balance, the other counterbalance.
I had to chuckle when you talked about, hey, adults don't know everything, because I've got a couple of soon to be 20-year-old twins that are my kids, and they're both in university. So they're on their own kind of for the first time. And of course, now they have to make decisions and do things. And they both have said at some point, wow, this whole adult thing kind of sucks.
Yeah. And, you know, I think unfortunately, we had parents that didn't have answers to some of our questions. because they were navigating a new world too. So I'd say, like, what are we supposed to do here? And dad would go, I don't know. Let's figure it out.
Yeah.
And that, like, created a decision-making mechanism internally at a young age of like, okay, I can make decisions. I can figure it out. I don't just go to mom and dad for decisions. So the leadership, the athlete developed over many years. And what you get, so let's take this back to teams, is you get founders, they're mid-20s, first time building a company, first time leading a team, and have absolutely no experience about how to lead a team aside from the fact that they watched the Steve Jobs documentary about how he rings people on the side when they don't do things well, right? Or aside from the one manager or two managers they had in early of their career who like either micromanaged them or gave them so much freedom. And so we either emulate or we rebel against the one style that we saw and have no actual formal or even informal understandings of the psychology of leadership and team dynamics. And we make a lot of silly mistakes, not because we don't know the answer. Actually, funny enough, when I ask people what they think the levels of high-performing teams are, I say 80% don't get the right order, but they get the right components. Most people know what makes a good team intuitively, but it's like a Rubik's Cube. You sort of know, okay, this side should be yellow and this side should be blue. Okay, great. Do you know how to get there? And it's that tweaking that makes it really difficult of how do I actually systematically build a team. And I think young people don't realize, young founders, the ego often doesn't realize how much impact we have on other individuals in our team. Leaders can have up to 7 times more impact on a single team than anyone else on that team. And it's hard to understand because we go, little old me, like, why are you taking my word so seriously? Like, it's just a thought. I didn't think my like little joke, this is often, I made a little joke and it really upset a staff member. Yeah, your impact is so much more magnified because you're in this leadership role.
Yeah, I think it was Shed, wasn't it? One of our previous podcast guests, that his take on it was, I hope I get this right, when you're a leader, a tiptoe becomes a stomp. And what's the other one? Robin, help me out here.
A whisper becomes a scream.
A whisper becomes a shout or a scream. Yeah, exactly.
A shout. Yes, a shout. Yes, it was shout. Yeah, very good.
Yeah. Often I tell our founders, your team is talking about you to their partners when they're having dinner. They're talking about you. They're talking about whether they had a good day or a bad day because of what you did. And I think that brings it home for some people that like, I'm really responsible. But with that weight, okay, so then how do I take team building intentionally?
Fahad, you said something really important I think everyone should hear, but especially if there are people who are out considering taking a leap and building something. And it's something that had resonated with me, and it didn't feel good at the time, but you said you didn't wait for permission from people. And I remember so many times people, oh, you're crazy, you're a dreamer, that won't work. And it's not like I sit here now and go, told you so. But I got to tell you, it feels really good that I had a vision. I was committed to it. I didn't know how I'd get there. And this podcast is one. I remember people saying, you're going to do a podcast. What are you doing that for? Do you know how to do a podcast? Mm-hmm. No, but I'll figure it out. Mm-hmm. And look what it's turned into, this amazing community of great people. And there's so many things that have come out of it that I can't even begin to explain, and wonderful friendships. And I think we're on that path as well. But you also, somewhere in that brilliant answer, because we could spend hours here because you're dropping so much gold here that we could just pick everything, you know, one point and talk for 45 minutes on each point. But it's something I was thinking about because you talked about psychological, I forget the context you had used it in, but it reminded me of something that came to the forefront a couple of years ago. You know, people started talking about psychological safety, right? So I'd love to get your take on that because as I understand it, it's a cornerstone of your leadership philosophy, right? So can you maybe talk about why it's so vital for team success and what are those steps that leaders can take to get to that point and create that environment?
Yeah, great point. So I'm going to do two things. I'm going to give you the overall model of the 6 levels of high-performing teams and how psychological safety fits into it. And then I'll dive deep into psychological safety. And I'll do the first part fairly quickly. So we've recognized is that teams have to go through stages. And the 3 stages that we've sort of put them in is the team that's a 1+1=0 team, where you are literally less than the sum of your individuals. So you come together and you're a group of people, but you're literally like, I'd be better if I was off on my own. You're a 1+1=0 team. Then there's what we call the 1+1=2 teams, that you're equal to the sum of your individual. At this point, you're a group. Everyone does their part, puts it together, and we hand in our work. Great, right? We're a little manufacturing, but we're a group. Then there's the 1+1=3, and that's I am better because I am with you. we as a team produce more than we could have ever done on our own. And that's the upper echelon of teamwork that people want to be in, that they dream about creating, but there's a lot of barriers between those. So to get through those, because we all start at the zero, but to get through those, the first layer of the six levels of high-performing teams, Robin, as you rightfully mentioned, is psychological safety. And I'll get into its definition a bit more. But the second layer right after, and so this is where teams get stuck at the 1+1=0. If they can't establish psychological safety, they actually remain as less than the sum of their individuals. They can't even get to the equal to, because there isn't an established trust, there isn't established group norms, there isn't established freedom of thought to be able to allow the best thoughts to actually thrive versus the person in charge. Because without psychological safety, we default to power dynamics, we default to personality dynamics. So I'll hold that. The next layer is what we call empowerment. So does your team feel empowered to make decisions and not wait for permission? Because unless I can create a team that doesn't wait for permission, then I'm stuck in the model of a genius with 1,000 helpers. I don't have a team yet, right? I just have one person that makes all the calls and everyone's just around them waiting, taking notes. So I need to actually create a permission. Like, there's still key permissions for like the big strategic stuff, but most stuff I need to pass through. After empowerment, I'm looking at effective communication. So how well do we have productive conflict and how well do we communicate without communication breaking down? So many part of team fails because teamwork is earned. You can't buy it, right? You have to earn it. And it's the same way when you learn to communicate with a friend, you learn to communicate with a partner, you learn to let you actually say what you mean versus dancing around it. The empowerment and effective communication is the 1+1=2. Most teams get stuck here. And the reason they get stuck here is because they never actually try and deal with psychological safety. They try to go around it by creating smaller teams and silos. And so they create silos, so they get smaller teams, so that there is psychological safety amongst the smaller teams, but not the larger team. And then you get stuck here. After effective communication, we get into a culture of leadership where leadership is fluid amongst the team and it's not actually hierarchical. Then we get into a sense of purpose and meaning and contribution. Most really good teams, why the Davids beat the Goliaths is because the Davids feel real sense of contribution and a real skin in the game. While the Goliaths, you're a cog in the machine and you start to let the machine live on its own and eventually it sort of fails. And the last part is the all-encompassing vision. Do we have a vision that's actually pulling us towards where we want to? And where the mistake the founders make, Robin, is, and you actually mentioned it a little bit when you were talking about your anecdote with the podcast, is that with the vision, founders feel like, I should know how I'm going to get there. No, that's overkill. No one really knows. No one knows how you're going to get there. But I've never met a founder that was successful that didn't say, I didn't know how I was going to get there, but I knew that I could figure it out. I had the confidence in my abilities to figure it out. I didn't know how, but I had the confidence of the path. So those are the six layers of high-performing teams. So then comes the question, okay, why is psychological safety the base? Because we build it as a pyramid. Why is it the base? Why is it the most important one? And the research first starts with Amy Edmondson's work in 1994 and 96. She's a researcher, and she goes to research in hospitals to try and see why are certain hospital surgeon teams more effective than others. And she found something really interesting, correlation in the data. She found that the teams that were more effective were reporting more mistakes. And it was confusing a bit. You're like, wait a second, why is the team that is scoring higher, they have more mistakes? That doesn't make sense. They shouldn't be scoring higher. They have more mistakes. She digs into it. It's not that they had more mistakes. It's that they were the ones actually reporting their mistakes. The other teams weren't reporting their mistakes. Oh, that mistake doesn't matter as much because if I report a mistake, I'm going to get in trouble. So fundamentally, the willingness to report a mistake showed something in the psychology of the group. Did I feel safe enough to go, hey, I messed up. Hey, this didn't work. Hey, we tried this. We made this mistake. Because it is only in that openness and vulnerability can you ever fix a mistake. Because if you don't report the mistake, you never fix it and you build on top of it and you only build a shaky foundation. So Amy Edmondson's work is then built upon over and over again, a few different researchers. And it becomes more popular as when Google does this Project Aristotle. They study 180 teams over 2 years, about like 5 million data points to try and identify what makes high-performing teams within their organizations. And they come to the same conclusion. They go, interactions between team members matters far more than the individual talent. And if interactions between team members matters far more, what are the interactions that matter? Their first conclusion is that there is a set of interactions that is understood. So there's group norms. that you understand the group norms. It's like when we go visit a new country that we've never been to. You go, okay, what's the norm here? What am I allowed to do? What am I not? Right? Your mind is hijacked trying to process what's allowed and what's not allowed instead of actually solving the problem. And so what Google recognizes is that known group norms immediately create for higher performing teams. And one of the key group norms was psychological safety. A sense that someone can take an interpersonal risk without fear of consequence. Now, it's really interesting because when we get into this and we start talking about psychological safety, you have another group of people, Robin, that go, okay, but all this nice fuzzy stuff, like we need hardcore builders. We need, right? I don't need any of this nicey stuff. And I go, whoa, psychological safety is not about being nice. Actually, psychological safety is having a safe enough space that we can call each other out. So we connect so we can correct. We connect so that we can make people better. Psychological safety and empowerment in our two levels go hand in hand. You can't empower people if they don't feel safe to make a decision. Otherwise, they're always going to come to you and go, so can we do this? Because what they're doing is they're passing off the risk to you. Every time someone's asking you for permission, what they're really doing is they're passing off the risk. So that if you say yes and you do it and it goes wrong, they go, well, I asked you. And they have less skin in the game. But I want people to have more skin in the game. No, I want you to own the decision so that if it messes up, it's also on you. Because the higher skin in the game you have, the more willingness you will have to actually see it through and fix it as you go. I don't want it to be you did it because of my permission. And that's the key piece of what people miss when they're critical of psychological safety, that it's not about being nice. It's actually about creating group-based trust. And some people will say, well, psychological safety is trust. Trust lives at an individual level. So you can trust one person in your team, and this is what happens. They go, well, I trust two out of the five people. And so what they do is they create a little mini team. And the group itself doesn't have psychological safety. So psychological safety lives at the group level. So those are a few points that I think some of our founders can take to think, do I have the space for experimentation and innovation? Because truly, if that's what you want, if you want the best ideas to win and not just the ideas of the leader, then it needs to be a space of psychological safety where people can debate in a powerless environment.
I'm so glad I asked the question, and I'm so glad you went through that at such a deep level, because the people that I speak to, and myself included, when we were building the company, honestly, that's not something that even was on my radar, Fahad, honestly, because I had assumed, of course, I'm comfortable speaking out and asking for things. The people that I brought onto the team, of course they're going to be. Right? But maybe they're not. So I think this is a really, really good reminder that this isn't something that just happens by default. We have to work at these types of things.
Correct. And it's different, Robin, when you were building the company and maybe you brought in a co-founder or another person that felt a little bit more equal. Maybe they'll debate a bit more and see how you react. They'll see how you react to debate, by the way. They're watching you, right? Oh, Robin didn't react well to me pushing back. Okay, that's a sense that I'm going to also pull back next time. That's why. But you bring in an employee, and an employee has a significantly different power dynamic with you. Without even realizing it, you control their livelihood. You pay for their food. You pay for their house. You pay for their family. So there's a real psychological like mechanism that comes into play of, I'll do what Robin says, right? And you actually don't want that because you want their genius. You don't want them to be an order taker. You want them to be an artist in their own way.
Exactly.
Although I would argue that there's still a lot of people that do want order takers.
There are people who want order takers. And you know what? Okay, so there is a caveat to this. I would say when we teach leadership, we teach it as principles. And for new managers and new leaders, we go, here are the principles, follow them. Then if you've been in leadership for a long time, I go, here are the principles and here's where they don't work. So right, like
yeah.
It's telling me, and there is a, when does psychological safety hurt you? In moments of extreme efficiency, you want order takers. So you're in a manufacturing plant. You actually want just enough pressure to increase the speed of someone's work, and you want repetitiveness. I don't want brainstorming, creativity, and debate, right?
Yeah.
Now, you still want leaders that are able to yank the and stop the production, but it's interesting. Also, as you mentioned, there are moments where less psychological safety actually benefits the efficiency of capital utilization.
Yeah.
But we're getting nerdy here for a moment.
We are, and that's okay. Yeah. But you did start to go down a path, which I then did want to pursue. It's a perfect segue into the next question. Can you talk about some common leadership pitfalls? Like, where do you see some significant mistakes that leaders make, and what can they do to avoid that?
Yeah, that's a good one. Common leadership pitfalls. I think the first leadership pitfall is the concept of the law of the lid, which is John Maxwell's concept. But it basically says that organizations and teams can only grow to the capacity of their leaders, which means that a team can't get better than you. You literally visualize a lid, and someone is going to try and outgrow, but what happens is they hit their head on the lid. And someone's going to try to innovate. And if the leader themselves isn't aware of their ego, have awareness of their own limitations, unconsciously, they're going to block their team from growing. And so what happens is leaders are going to try and hire, hire people that are better than you, right? But that's actually hard to do because ego gets in the way, emotion gets in the way, money gets in the way. You hire people better than you, it's expensive. So at first you hire a lot of juniors. And when you're building your team, you end up hiring a lot of juniors and they become order takers. And then you go, nobody gets it. Nobody knows what I need. I have to do everything. And so the founder becomes a real operator. They go inside the business. They end up spending so much time. And because they're really good at the operator, they think that their way to eventual success is to just operate their way through it. And I think earlier we said, we still want the founder to operate in their zone of genius, but every founder and every leader needs to eventually find the highest leverage points. Leadership is leverage. Leadership is about finding the areas of leverage, whether that's your team, whether that's a technology you can build, whether that's thought leadership and brand, right? A podcast is leverage because you create it once and then it could be used on masses. So it has a leverage point. And so the two come in hand. The law of the lid ensures that leaders have to either face the mirror at one point and go, if I don't make myself better, my team will never be better. I am their limitation. And the other part of law of the lid is that leader doesn't realize that as long as I spend my time operating every little detail and I can't find the highest leverage points, I'm not going to be able to actually have exponential impact. I will only ever have the impact of I'm going to work harder. I'm going to work an extra hour. I'm going to work an extra 3 hours. I'll work the weekend, which are micro improvements of the business and never fully. So those are two very common traps that we see, that they get stuck because they don't actually invest in their own learning. They get stuck because they don't identify the highest leverage points. Beyond that, what we see is with leverage points is that a lot of founders don't, and in leadership, they don't understand systems. So they go, okay, I need to focus on my team. So then they start diving into I'm going to have one-on-ones with everyone. I'm going to make sure they're feeling good. Al's feeling good. Robin's feeling good. And go, wait. Team dynamics isn't just about feeling good. It's about giving people the right tools to empower them, to make them better, whether that's training them up, whether that's putting them on the right pieces, whether that's ensuring they're using the right skills. And so one of the things that we've developed over the years is what we've called the founder operating system, which is an adaptation of EOS that many people know, the entrepreneur operating system. We've adapted the founder operating system because we found that for startups, they didn't need EOS, which is a bit more small, medium-sized business. They needed something that worked more with tech and scale and kind of the speed in which technology changes. So a little bit more adapt, a little bit more agile. And so the third part was whether leaders can develop systems. So that's another trap they get into. Am I just trying to manage my day-to-day and just get through it, or week-to-week? Or can I develop a system in which this company, this organization, this team can operate without me, right? And the founder operating system is about pushing leadership responsibilities down so that you can scale your leadership. That's another trap that we get into. And the reason you get into it is because of a good old adage. What's the good old adage? Lead by example. And that's a good one. But do you see the trap of lead by example over the long run? Because you can't do it all. Lead by example means I've got to do it all and I've got to be the example for it all. So I got to do it and I got to run faster if I want people to run. No, I need you to operate a machine. I need you to operate a system. And so what's interesting is that we have these little old adages, right? If you want anything done right, do it yourself, right? There's a lot of these little adages that we have in the back of our head. And what happens is they actually get in the way of good leadership, right? I'm going to do it myself. No one can do it. I'll just get it done. Instead, and so what I see is that they jump in and they make decisions for their team. But when you see your team made a bad decision, actually just push it back and go, hey, I would relook at this decision with some new lens versus here's the decision I need to make. Now, one's shorter, one's faster, but one forces a permission style. So what happens is that you can fall back into not empowering your team. You empower them for a bit and then you start answering all the questions again for them and you fall back into it, right? There's a point at one point when your son asks you in university, you go, Dad, what do you think I should do? You go, well, what do you think you should do? And you have an answer and you want to tell them. Uh-huh. But in all of your will, you have to not tell them. and hope that you can sort of maneuver your way to letting them come to their own decision, because that's power. And that's the other trap that leaders get in.
Oh, yeah. Well, everything you said there, pretty much at some point or another, you can see yourself in the mirror when you're discussing all those things. I'm sure everyone is thinking the same.
You know what, Al? I think what's interesting is I think entrepreneurs face the mirror more often than an employee. An employee doesn't have to face the mirror, because if something's not working, they go, well, we need to get another team member. We need to hire someone else. They hit a block, someone else can fix it for them. An entrepreneur, when something's not working, you're forced to look in the mirror and go, well, that's me.
Yeah.
Who else can fix it, right? And so you're actually forced to grow. You're forced to improve if you want to grow the company. An employee, you can sort of hide within the team. And I think that's why so many entrepreneurs seek personal development. They seek growth. They see, because they realize they're the barrier.
Yeah, you said something earlier that you're the limiting factor. If you're what's holding things back, then you got to do something a little different. And it's very true. I find myself thinking about that sometimes.
Yeah. And myself too. I said the worst part of running a leadership development company is that all of your team expects you to be the best leader. And you go, listen,
I'm still figuring it out here.
I'm going to fall to some of these mistakes too, in these traps, because they are biological in nature, mm-hmm. right? Like, they're intuitive from the, like, oh, strategically, I know what I should do. Most of us know what good leadership is from a knowledge base, but it's hard from an actual action, emotional base.
Fahad, you're segueing into my next question. And I'm very curious your answer, actually, before we get to Al's signature question, which, by the way, is my favorite part of the episode. But I did want to ask you, when you're faced to look in the mirror and you've, let's face it, if you're running a company, you're going to have some great days, a lot of great days. It is fun, but you're going to have those days where, and I'll say it nicely, crap hits the fan. Who is your go-to to talk to when crap hits the fan?
That's a good question. I've got three people that are my go-to, okay? I mean, naturally, my wife. And the reason for, now it's funny, and she'll be both offended and happy I said this. I don't go to her for advice about the business. I go to her to cheer me up, because she's like the happiest person on earth. She's like, no matter what happens in life, she's like, oh, Vod, life's great. Like, look at us. Look. And she's just like one of those people that's just, you know, she's got a bit of ADHD. Her name's Andrea and her last name is Dark. So we call it the Andrea Dark Happiness Disorder.
I cannot wait for Andrea to hear this.
Yeah. She's got this bubbly sense of life. And so when I'm down, I go, oh, this happened. And she'll just like raise me back up. She won't have the best ideas on how to fix things. I love her to death, but it's just not her skill set, right? So for one, for sometimes I need a little boost, I got that. So a mentor told me this, and I'm actually going to mention him. He goes, in life, like in your mentorship, you need to have a plus one, someone who's ahead of you and where you want, someone who's equal to where you are, and then someone you mentor. And those are my three people here to kind of answer that question. So Andrea, I go to talk with. My mentor, Julian LeBlanc, local Ottawa guy, has been running a leadership management consulting for major food groups. He works with McCain. He was an executive there. We met through some networking, and we've had a relationship for the last 6-7 years where I call him up and go, hey, what's going on? Hey, I'm struggling with this. And we've had this really phenomenal mentorship. He's not a formal coach. I don't pay him, but he calls me sometimes. He's like, how do you do all this media stuff? How do you do this TikTok? And so there's this two-way mentorship, and he has been a phenomenal sounding board. And honestly, sometimes the sounding board is just get through it. Just get through it. Just get to the next one. Don't worry. The next one. Like, keep on it. He goes, the point of business is to stay in business long enough to find the success, right? Stay in it long enough to find it. And so I've got a great relationship with a younger speaker trainer, Sam Dema, who is a good friend now. And he is a ball of energy, but he speaks to universities and high schools about unpacking, you know, your own baggage and mental health. And he's got this great, and man, just spending an hour with him, I'm like, I love how optimistic and like, because I years in business, Robin, I'm sure sometimes you just feel like, ah, this is not going to work, right? You get down on yourself and you believe it, but sometimes and he has a sense of optimism of, you know, I know I'm young too, but his youthful optimism just like goes, okay, I need a bit of that. I'm going to take a bit of that. That was good. I needed to hear that, right? So that's where I go to. I go to my community. I think many of us, when shit hits the fan, we sort of retreat. That's the natural instinct. We go into ourselves. And I read many years ago in a really good book, I forget which one, it said, well, we need to do the exact opposite. When things hit the fan, you actually should reach out to the people who you know can help reset perspective instead of the retreat that is the very natural instinct.
That's very good advice. And it sounds like you've built a network of people around you that support you in different ways. And again, I think that's a great reminder for other people that you should have those people. And honestly, I would hope that when this episode comes out, Fahad, I would hope you would share it with those three people, because I think it's important for them to know how important they are in your life as well. And we'll carry on this more maybe philosophical direction that we're going on the podcast, because Al has got his famous question by this point, his signature question, all lined up for you. And I'm curious to hear your answer.
I'm always going to look at ADHD in a different light now. So that was great. Yes. So here we go. A society grows great when old persons plant trees in whose shade they will never sit. So maybe you can talk about, you know, through Unicorn Labs, you empower leaders to build transformative teams and create impactful change. So maybe you can talk a little bit about what proverbial trees you're planting today. Could be personally, could be professionally, to ensure a lasting legacy for future leaders and generations.
Yeah, I love that question. I think I love it, Al, because it's such a personal philosophy of mine. What got me started in all of this, the story that I use, I guess that I say got me started, was in high school. A friend of mine comes up to me and says, let's try and build this like camp activity for the school that we went to in elementary school, like for March break camp, let's do this thing. And I'm like, God, this is stupid. We're in high school. We don't know what we're doing. And he convinces me to do it. And to this day, it's a story I tell because it transformed who I was. I think in the process of planting the tree, we also become a different person. I'm of Arabic heritage and Islamic faith, and there is an Islamic quote that says, as you help a man climb a mountain, you will realize you also made it up the mountain. And I think it's this notion of service. It's this notion of helping others. I truly believe that what we're doing with leadership development is, one, we unlock the talent that people have, the inner genius, the inner brilliance that they've shied away from, to allow them to plant those trees. Two, when we're building these better teams, we spend most of our time at work. And so if we can build places of work that feel contributive to society, that understand the responsibility that they hold and aren't just money printing machines to kind of move along a capitalist system, then I think that we are effectively changing the way people approach work, the way people approach business. And then I think, to get a little bit political and philosophical, I think there's a zeitgeist across Canada too, where there's a little notion that around immigration that isn't as lovely as it used to be, and people are struggling with it. And I go, I'm a story of immigration. And I think sometimes the tree that I'm planting is the seed in Canadians to remind ourselves of our values, that, you know what? Yeah, as a country, we stumble as we try and find the right pieces of our culture. But remember that our culture is worldly. We have people from all across. And my father always reminds me of this. He goes, when you're on stage, you know, in a way, you represent people of Arabic heritage. You represent Muslim people. You represent your generation. You show what can be. And I think that's the big tree that I'm thinking about planting lately in Canadian society, to remind ourselves of like the kind, collective, mosaic culture that we have, and not to pull ourselves too far as things have gotten difficult economically. So that's where my head goes when you ask me that question now.
Yeah, and I love that. And you hit on so many things there. And again, we could probably take another half hour, hour, and just talk about some of the things you said there. But no, I really appreciate that. That was great.
Thank you. Thank you both for...
Yeah, no, thank you. I was just going to say, I was going to give a shout out to Tech Talent North and the TAP Network, who runs it. And of course, Michelle Brooks, who was an amazing MC that day, because that is the reason, the fact that these events get put on and they bring in amazing speakers like you, Fahad. And now, like I said at the beginning of the podcast, I see a friendship growing between us.
Yes.
And I'm very grateful for that. So thank you for things like that happening, but get us to know great people. For listeners interested in learning more about what you're doing, about you and your firm, what's the best way for people to reach out?
Yeah, unicornlabs.ca. That's our website. You'll find it there. You'll find all the information. Of course, LinkedIn, Fahad Al-Hattab, if you can manage to write my full name. I'm sure you'll find it in the show notes. But Unicorn Labs is usually easier. Start there and you'll find everything else. I've got an amazing team of people that you can connect with. We offer leadership development. We offer team building. We offer strategy work and in many different ways, whether it's keynotes, it's workshops, it's one-on-one coaching. So there's many ways you can work with us if you found there's some of these principles that you want to install into your team.
Well, awesome. I love your energy. I never walk away from a conversation with you without at least another couple levels of energy up. So, well, that does it for today's episode. We really enjoyed this conversation. As always, we hope you did too. If you have any questions for Al or myself, please feel free to give us a call or by joining the conversation on LinkedIn. We saw it here today. Success leaves clues, my friends. We'll see you next time.